This is Clusterfucked. Here's your host, Roger King.
Welcome to another episode of Clusterfucked. I'm Roger King. Now, the tagline of this podcast is a liberal host, but with red state guests. But I'm sort of breaking the rules today, or at least bending them, because my guest is not in a red state. I don't think he is. And he's a liberal. Now, we have liberals on the show, of course, but they're usually in red states because we want to know what's going on the ground there. But another thing I want to do on this podcast is to get liberals to think differently on certain issues and certain strategies. Because, of course, the goal is to win more elections by persuading people who don't already agree with liberals. So, while my guest today is a fellow liberal, he's been known to take stances that sometimes go against conventional liberal thinking. That's why I think he's a must-read writer. He's a contributing editor to Politico magazine and a writer for Real Clear Politics, and the author a few years back of a book called Wait, Don't Move to Canada, A Stay-and-Fight Strategy to Win Back America. So as a podcaster in Canada, advising Americans also to stay in the U.S. and maybe move within the U.S., I thought it was only natural I have him on the show. Bill Scherer, welcome to Clusterfucked.
Thanks so much for having me.
So off the top, let's dive right into talking about conventional liberal thinking. I just wanted to ask you, is there one thing that leaps to mind that you think our fellow liberals get wrong about politics in general, or it could be a particular issue, but is there something that leaps to mind?
Well, you know, we got to define our terms. Unfortunately, I hate defining terms, but these days you need to. I think using the term liberal kind of broadly to encompass of everybody on the left, but I do think there are gradations that are relevant here. The insurgent left, which tends to define themselves more as populists or democratic socialists,
or progressives,
progressive is one that I think, like Joe Lieberman called himself progressive. So there is an attempt by some to, you know, not allow people to claim that mantle. In fact, I'm going to pronounce his name wrong. Sean McElwee was the Data for Progress and is considered sort of a policy architect and political strategist behind, Ocasio-Cortez and some others in this realm.
Yeah, the abolish ICE movement and that sort of thing.
Yes, he kind of cut his teeth on pushing abolish ICE, and he's been a big guy behind Green New Deal. He said to Vox that Green New Deal was that if you were not for Green New Deal, you were therefore not progressive.
Right.
Since this is a show that can drop F bombs, he said, you know, you'll get on the train or choo choo, motherfucker, was his phrase. So there is an attempt there to say this is what progressive means, and if you are more of a moderate, more of a pragmatist, then you don't count in that. And so all the folks in that realm, you know, populist, progressive, socialist realm, they have been arguing that there is zero need to compromise in any respect, and arguably there's zero need to do a lot of persuasion. Maybe there are some people in the middle, who will be attracted to, your bold, ambitious plans, but it's more about energizing your own side and winning through sheer force of numbers. I wrote a book at this point a long time ago, the 2006 book, Wait to Move to Canada, which was somewhat novel in its day of saying, you know, embrace the word liberal. Don't throw it, don't kick it to the curb, define it on your terms, be proud, be confident, and I would still argue that. But I think you are seeing in 2019 that logic being taken too far, where people think you can just be for whatever and expect it to have salience, as if that the other side doesn't have cards to play in ways that they can energize their own bases and give you lots of trouble.
Right. Well, it's funny. We didn't set this up beforehand, but you've actually segued into the second question I had in mind to ask you, because I did note that when you wrote that book, Don't Move to Canada, you said embrace the term liberal as often and as openly as possible. And I was going to ask you if you still felt that way, which you seem to, as you just said. So what did you mean by that exactly? Since you said off the top we should define liberal, what did you mean in that case?
Well, what I wrote in the book was I define liberal by the three R's, representative, responsive, and responsible, as a way to give, you know, government a good name again. You know, this is, you know, back in the Bush days, even going back to the Clinton days or Reagan days, you know, government itself was getting a bad name, a bad rap as the L word as well. You know, that was most famous in the 1988 Dukakis campaign. And I agree, and I was, you know, on the forefront of this argument at the time, that if you're not defending yourself, if you get hit with the liberal slur and your response is, oh no, I'm something else. Well, you're basically acknowledging or agreeing that to be a liberal is bad. And if to be a liberal is bad, then how can you get to the place where you say government is good? If you're promoting activist government policies, well, you got to be able to defend that. And that's inevitably going to be characterized as liberal. I was never arguing that was an easy thing to do, but to abandon the project was to be self-defeating. And so I maintain that to this day. You don't want to you don't want to operate from a crouch position. But in being proud of your basic values, your worldview, your philosophy of government, that doesn't automatically mean that whatever policy you hang on that framework is going to be a slam dunk. You still have to recognize that, you know, most people are not deeply political, not deeply ideological, won't accept your arguments immediately at face value. And so you do have to take some effort to put yourself in somebody else's shoes.
In order to make the case.
One, to make the case, like what language you use to make the case, but also to some extent, how ambitious do you get on policy? So it's one thing to say, for example, it's a principle of mine that every person should have health insurance. No, your healthcare is a right, and everybody should have affordable coverage. How you get there, that is a source of more debate. And sure, if you were for single payer coverage, that would meet your goal. But if you have evidence that there's going to be a lot of political resistance to that, it's not selling out or getting defensive or otherwise being weak to say, maybe I should think about two or three or four other ways to get to that goal that might have more resonance.
Well, and I think you've captured two ends of the spectrum where I don't think, you know, as liberals we want to be, which is the McElwain, you know, sort of like my way or the highway, but you don't want to be someone who, as you said, accepts the opposition's caricatures and crouches, as you said. You want to be somewhere where you're proud of what you believe in, but recognize you actually have to persuade people. I mean, that is kind of where I'm at with some of the my way or the highway people you described is, they describe the country they wish it was rather than the country it is. Would you agree with that assessment?
Yeah. I mean, I think most of those folks on the harder left see politics as very zero sum, and that it can only be one, that it can only be won through, through base energization. Anything in the American political structure that is an obstacle to that, be it the filibuster or the electoral college, things of that nature, things that make a lot of American politics super majoritarian, they should be overridden in whatever way possible. They want to remove any procedural obstacle to enacting their sort of desired policies, and generally their maximalist policies, eke them through 50% plus one, and that's all that should be expected. In some cases, they'll make a sort of pragmatic argument. Look at these Republicans. Look at how obstructionist they are. How could you possibly think about working with them? There's no way you're going to get anything you want working with them. The only way you're going to get anything done is by removing those obstacles. And I think that is one thing is wrong. Not that work with Republicans is in any way easy. There's obviously deep-seated conservatism and a huge appetite for obstructionism on the right. I'm not negating that at all. But I do think that people miss a lot of what happened in the Obama era. A lot of the obstructionism was very prominent, and the bipartisanship was more quiet. But the reality is that literally every single bill that Barack Obama signed into law, with one exception, that being the Affordable Care Act, got to his desk with Republican votes. Not necessarily a lot of Republican votes, right. But at least one. In some cases, more than one. And if his if your attitude was that simplistic, there's no point in talking to those people. So I'm not even going to try. Then there wouldn't have been a stimulus. There wouldn't have been Dodd-Frank Wall Street regulations. There wouldn't have been a reduction in crack cocaine sentencing. There wouldn't have been food safety regulations. There wouldn't have been a don't ask, don't tell repeal. You can't go in, as horrible as Republicans have been, I don't think it's correct to say the only way we can get something done is by, say, eliminating the filibuster and winning a bunch of elections. And forgive me if I'm ranting for a little bit.
No. Understood. The rant is understood.
But there's two big problems with eliminating the filibuster. One is an assumption that if you had 50 Democrats, you get whatever you want. And the fact that the Democrats are a Big Ten party, and you see in the Green New Deal resolution, which is being talked about as if every Democrat is for it, and the vast majority of Democrats in Congress are not for it.
Well, we had 60 Democrats and barely got Obamacare.
Right. Exactly. You had to do people said, why did you bother compromising with Republicans on Obamacare? You didn't even get any. Well, you still had to get Joe Lieberman, you had to get Evan Baugh, you had to get Ben Nelson, and you had to get Blanche Lincoln, and that was hard. And so you have to compromise within your own party pretty much all the time. You almost never have unanimity, even amongst yourselves.
Right.
So the notion that just tacking out that procedural roadblock solves your problem, I think, is wrong.
Well, and of course, it'll backfire once a Republican administration gets elected. And, you know, it's a very short-sighted solution. I saw a video piece where you were advising the Democrats coming up to 2020 not to run on single payer or Medicare for all or whatever anyone wants to call it. Now, this was a couple of years ago. It would appear that many of the presidential candidates did not take your advice based on what we've seen so far. Do you still feel the same way? And if so, what worries you about that issue?
Well, I mean, just as I'm not so worried about it as a electoral matter, although I think there is an argument to be made that it would be electorally complicated. It may not fly at a general election. There's conflicting poll numbers one could cite. You know, if you ask any single payer advocate, they will very eagerly tell you that single payer polls great. And that's true.
Until you get into the details.
In the details, that support starts to decline very, very rapidly, and that's why. And so it comes down to how does the debate go? I mean, you're not going to get to run on it in top line form. You have to respond to criticisms, and maybe I hold out the possibility that someone is really good at responding to those criticisms and can win the argument. But we haven't actually seen that happen yet. But even if you could, and it's also possible that. Even if people don't like the idea of it, they hate Trump so much that they'll vote for the Democrat or whatever it is that they're proposing. So it's possible that you could win on that platform. But the implementation of getting a single-payer bill through Congress, I think, is a whole other matter. We have seen time and time again that healthcare legislation is complicated.
Mm-hmm.
We saw it with Hillary Care, we saw it with Obamacare, we saw it with Obamacare repeal. And pretty much every time, James Carville has a quote saying, the mover on healthcare loses. To do something is to lose. Now, that should not make someone so defeatist to say, well, I'm going to let people, you know, die early because I didn't have the guts to deal with the political complications of it. But you should be full aware that there will be political consequences to pursuing healthcare, as well as lots of other ambitious legislation. And so why would you take on that task when you have just gone through hell, political hell, getting the Affordable Care Act in? You have created a pretty robust infrastructure that can still be built upon to get to fully universal health care. I mean, the idea of the Affordable Care Act is universal health care. There's just some gaps in it. It'd be much easier to sort of tighten up those screws than to clear the decks and start over when there are other big issues like climate change, for example, which I do agree is the most pressing issue facing us. Whatever position, whatever policy you pursue is going to expend a lot of political capital. I don't see why you would put single payer at the top of the list unless you are trying to drive a wedge through the Democratic Party and have people get divvied up between the hardcore left and the squishy sellout moderates. So I don't think it's even the people who are taking on single payer now, like Kamala Harris and Cory Booker and Kirsten Gillibrand. These are folks who were not for single payer before. Elizabeth Warren is in that camp too. They were only for single payer after they, I think, decided in their minds, I'm going to run for president and I don't want Bernie to outflank me on the left. But if one of those folks actually wins, they may be stuck with having raised the expectations of the Democratic base to an absurd degree and not able to actually follow through in just the way Republicans suffered not being able to follow through on their promises to repeal Obamacare.
Right, and it's taken a decade for even Obamacare to reach positive numbers in the polling. So back to your point about healthcare being a tougher slog than people want to make it. And I think, you know, one of the things that, like you mentioned earlier, the polling on single payer, it always looks good sort of on the top line. But I find a lot of people in the Democratic camp are, I'm not going to say they're not being honest, but they're not addressing the big elephant in the room. Everyone wants everyone to be covered, and that isn't really the big issue. The big issue would be that I think it's 80% of Americans get their coverage from their employer, and you would basically be saying, we're going to cancel all those plans, and you move over to the government plan. And we've seen that Americans are quite resistant to change, and that would be dramatic change, and that needs to be addressed by people who are running on this, I think.
And if you ask Bernie or other candidates that point, they will say that once you tell people that you can see any doctor you want, and we're going to add in dental care and add in vision, and you're not going to pay premiums anymore, you know, your taxes might go up, but after your premiums get washed away, you're going to come out ahead. Once they see what a good deal this is, they will get behind it. And you know, if a Bernie or similar candidate becomes the nominee, you will definitely see that theory tested in real time. Where I am skeptical is that, let me put it this way. I think on the left, it is very common to conclude that the reason why we can't have nice things is because, you know, of corporate influence, corporate money, dark money, warping the debate, buying off politicians. Mm-hmm. And so if we have, so as long as we have the power to overcome that and robust small donor networks, we can, we don't have to persuade anybody about these arguments because they're so obvious. They're so straightforward. We just need to be able to overwhelm the corporate forces that are, stymieing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that is correct analysis. I think what that misses, is that, you can win there's a way to overcome corporate money in an election. It's been done before. What you can't squelch completely is corporate speech during the legislative debate. They will spend money on ads, mm-hmm. And on mailers and whatnot, no matter what you do. There's no campaign finance law you can pass that can stop that. So they're going to have their arguments. And you have to be able to respond to those arguments. And the key argument, I think, that is the toughest for single payer advocates to deal with, it's not just that you can't, if you like your healthcare, you can keep it, right? Which doesn't hold, in single payer. It's that you have to trust that the plan you're going to be put into, run by the federal government, is going to take care of you forever, not just in the first day. I'm telling you today, you can get whatever you want, and it's going to cost you less. Can you promise that in 5 years, in 10 years, in 20 years? What if something goes wrong? What if there's a big economic crisis and our tax revenue is depleted? Are you going to have to say we got to cut some service, and I have no other recourse to get it from somewhere else? Now, you may say these types of criticisms are histrionic, unfair, they're loaded, that may be. But to win the argument, the public has to trust that the federal government is going to be to handle the entirety of the health insurance system. And look, again, I am a liberal. I believe we should be defending the competency and the ability of government to do good things. But I think what is tricky for your average populist socialist is they often criticize government too as being inherently corrupt and distrustful. The system is rigged, all that kind of thing. Now, of course, they would argue, if you put me in office, then they won't be rigged anymore.
No, that's exactly it. It's like government's horrible, terrible. They're doing awful things, so let's have more of it. That's kind of, you know.
So I think that is a hard puzzle for the left to solve, because they prey upon people's natural skepticism of authority and bureaucracy to say the system is rigged, you should get rid of it. And they don't know how to supplant that with, well, when we're in charge, bureaucracy is going to be great and you're going to have any problems at all. And so when Obamacare had its problems, as most new programs do, you did not see a lot of single payer people say, oh, you know, look, this is just a bump in the road. This happened with Social Security. This happens with the Peace Corps. You know, this happens with a lot of new programs. But, you know, give them a couple years to get their sea legs and it's going to work out. Instead, it was looked at, this proves that a public-private model is clunky and awkward and inherently flawed, and should have been pursued in the first place. And that's why you gotta just, you know, burn it all down. I think squaring all that is very tricky for the hard left to pull off.
Well, and, you know, this gets back to, again, the theme of the podcast, or what I want the theme to be, is to, you know, to be able to persuade people, you have to understand the arguments that are going to be made. And I think some of the frustration on the progressive left simply comes from the fact of the system that we have. I mean, of the Electoral College, and every state gets two senators. You know, the fact is, people are just not progressive in Indiana. And in order for them to be so, we've either got to do, well, probably both things. My idea on this podcast of literally moving to places like Indiana so there'll be more liberals there. But also, we've got to make the case, and you hinted at this earlier when you're talking about how they view sort of corporate money and all that. I was thinking about that when I asked you the first question about what do people misunderstand about politics, and you sort of touched on it. The role of money, I think, is misunderstood. I'll give one short example. You know, the sort of the cry on the left about an organization like the NRA is always, oh, you know, the politicians are bought off by the NRA. It's the money, it's the campaign money. But that's not really where their power comes from. The power of the NRA comes from their membership and how these people vote. And you can motivate them to vote, and they will crawl across glass to vote on that one issue. And so that's kind of what some Republican politicians are afraid of. It's the voters. It's not, oh, here comes the campaign money. That's a secondary thing to it, I think. Would you agree with that assessment?
I would, and I would add, in the case of the NRA, it's the culture that they, you know, what they spend their money on is not just buying politicians. Mm-hmm. They're giving to politicians that are already in their stead. They haven't taken a gun control politician and turned him or her into a gun rights politician. They have built a culture where a chunk of the population, not a majority, but a significant chunk of it, believes that a gun is a symbol of their individuality and freedom.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that over time, as hunting became less popular, that it would become easier to pass gun control, because it wouldn't be about taking away guns that you need for your livelihood or for your recreation. But what the NRA did is that they shifted their main arguments away from protecting the rights of hunters into personal safety. If you took money out of the system, out of the political campaign system, and look, if I was president and someone gave me a public campaign finance bill, I'd sign it. I have zero problem with that. But it would not change the ability of corporations and special interest groups to spend money on the debate. And if you don't have so you need to have aggressive operation, you need to have good messaging, you need to be able to have policies that can generate broad appeal to deal with that. But if a Democrat takes money from a corporate source, it doesn't mean that that Democrat ceases to think independently about how to govern properly.
Mm-hmm.
There's been an attempt to treat every corporate dollar as inherently corrupting and toxic. And just the history doesn't prove that. Teddy Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, FDR, Barack Obama, they all took corporate money, and they all regulated corporations afterward. That's the key thing. You're never going to have a Democratic politician or any politician on the left side of things who's going to be solely funded by corporations. I mean, if your entire base was corporate executives, then yeah, you'd probably be very inclined to pass legislation that only benefits them. But a Democrat politician is never going to be solely financed by corporations. There's always going to be a small donor component, always going to be a grassroots populist element. And pretty much every Democratic politician, every Democratic president balances the needs of the broader public and special interest, including corporate interests. And they develop compromises that try to satisfy all those folks. This is not a satisfying argument to those on the populist socialist side because they don't want to give corporations even one seat at the table.
They also expand their definition all the time, you know, like when Beto O'Rourke was able to raise all that money, there were still some on the left who were critical because supposedly some of it was oil and gas money. But if you're in Texas, I mean, you can't turn the corner without bumping into someone who works in the oil and gas industry. These were individual donations, but they happened to work for an oil and gas company. And so that's now called corporate money by some in the groups you're talking about.
Right. And then in those cases, that's not even corporate executives. That might just be, you know, a secretary who works for ExxonMobil, and that becomes oil gas money.
Right. Let's turn to 2020 before we wrap this up. Your opinion on first, you know, well, it might be the same answer. I don't know. But in who you would want to win sort of in your heart, and who do you think has the best chance to win just from a political perspective?
I will answer neither question. Largely because I write about this stuff. I write about it for Politico and Real Clear Politics. So I can't say I'm for person X because then that colors all of your analysis
right
afterwards. And that's not just me being crafty. I have a secret favorite. I'm just not telling you. I also believe fully that it doesn't make sense for anybody at this stage of the game to have a singular favorite. All of these candidates have a lot to prove on the campaign trail. They have to prove they know how they're going to take on Trump. They have to prove they know how to defend their policy positions. They have to prove they know how to woo voters in formerly red, what have been red states. And if they believe that the strategy is base mobilization, show me you know how to do that. If you believe you can flip Trump voters, show me the Trump voters you are flipping. I just think people should be putting these folks through their paces in a big, big way, whether they are, you know, totally newbie candidates like, you know, Pete Buttigieg in South Indiana, or whether it's Joe Biden, who's been a politician for 40 years. They all need to prove themselves that they can execute what they claim they can execute. And so I don't think I make no assumptions who's going to be the best at that at this stage of the game.
A very tactful response. But I agree with you. I've been saying, too, like, I don't think it's a negative at all that we have a lot of candidates. You know, it's going to be a battle of ideas. It'll be fascinating. And I mean, I was thinking the other day, reminding myself of, you know, that it's not a winner-take-all system on the Democratic side with the primaries. And so it's delegates by proportion of the vote. So it could be a long slog in 2020. But I think for the most part, it's positive that all these people are joining in. And I think you're going to see a lot of interesting ideas and debates, and looking forward to it.
And the question becomes, we're going to have that robust debate. And it's going to be, I think, very uncomfortable and tense at times.
Mm-hmm.
And the challenge is, after that robust debate occurs, does everybody lock arms and unify at the end of the process? And I think that's a big open question. You know, I think those who are sort of eager to throw a lot of punches will say, oh, we can have a robust debate and get together. You know, Obama and Clinton had a robust debate and they were fired at the end. And that was true, arguably less true when it was Clinton Sanders in 2016. So it's not just, you know, here I am being sort of critical of, you know, the socialist left and the populist left, but if a more moderate nominee wins the primary, but angers the left so much that they go vote Green Party, well, that's not good. That's not going to be a way to beat Trump. And if a more populist candidate wins and the more moderate pragmatists are angry and they go vote for Howard Schultz, that's not good either.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, part of the question for all the candidates is not just how are you going to defeat Trump, or how are you going to win swing voters, how are you going to keep this party together? That, I think, is just as critical a question as the other questions.
Yeah, we can count on Trump to blow up 1,000 news cycles between now and then and rally people, though, at least. That's probably the biggest secret weapon.
And he will meddle in the race. He will troll. He will try to drive wedges through Democrats. And that presents opportunities for Democrats to show how I'm going to deal with this guy. He's giving me the opportunity for me to show you my stuff. But if Democrats take his bait and divide amongst themselves, then the trolling is going
to
work.
It remains to be seen. We shall see. Thanks, Bill Scherer. Really appreciate you joining us in the clusterfuck room here today. Appreciate your insights.
My pleasure. Take care.
Okay. Thanks. Bill Scherer, contributing editor to Politico magazine and a writer for Real Clear Politics. He's also at least an occasional guest on CNN or MSNBC. So if you Google him, you'll find lots of stuff he's written and lots of interviews and TV appearances and other podcast things he's done. And you can follow him on Twitter at Bill Scherer. That's B-I-L-L-S-C-H-E-R, at Bill Scherer. Speaking of Twitter, you can follow me as well. Why not? I'm the civil liberal, but my handle on Twitter is at CF the podcast. And we're on Facebook as well. Just search CF the podcast. You'll find us. You can like us on there. We, of course, post the episodes and much more content connected to everything going on at CF headquarters and the different topics we like to talk about. And of course, the place to go to listen to other episodes is cfthepodcast.com. That's the website. We love when you visit us there. There's the mailing list you can join, and we will update you when a new episode is released, and of course, anything else we might be doing at CF headquarters. So that's cfthepodcast.com, and support the podcast as well if you so choose. We love it when you throw a few dollars our way, covering our expenses in this labor of love. Our recording studio is dbaudio.ca. We love them, and it does cost a little bit, as does the website and the website hosting and all the rest. So if you do want to support this podcast, click support the podcast at that website, cfthepodcast.com. And we are available on iTunes and Stitcher and Google Play and Spotify and all the rest. But again, visiting the website is probably the best way to keep up to date on episodes and joining the mailing list. Thanks for listening.
The Clusterfuck Podcast, a liberal host with red state guests.
This is Roger King. That'll be all.